Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw for this episode. I'm happy to be joined by Mr. Rob Sweeney of Kino Lorber and the general world of cinema.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on and sharing your latest movie watching. One thing, there was just no way that I would know about this movie or even know that you had seen it. Something you saw recently that is your highlight of recent viewing.
Yeah, it's with a bullet, with many bullets. It's a documentary about Cannibal Corpse called Centuries of Torment. And it's 3 hours long. And it really builds a portrait of the metal scene in Buffalo, New York in the late 80s and all the way through their through a tour in like 2007. 87 to 2007 is the time frame. And I found it to be like a fascinating portrait of a band's mutating over the years, of a music scene in Buffalo, of the transformation of that scene over time. And then they leave, they go from Buffalo to Tampa, and the development of the death metal scene in Tampa is a whole other story. And that's where it really like took off for reasons I didn't really know until I watched the documentary. And also the guys in the band are these just regular dudes. I mean, Cannibal Corpse, they're infamous for their horrifically gory lyrics, but like they're just sweet, a bunch of sweet guys like hanging out. And the documentary has like no, there's very little drama. Like even when guys leave the band, it's just like, you know, I wasn't feeling like I just wanted to do something else, you know? I found it to be very reassuring and quite beautiful viewing experience. Shot on video, like it looks like garbage as you would hope it would. Like the footage of them playing in like dingy bars, it's like staring through white noise. And directed by Denise Korsicki. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right. I guess she did a lot of bonus content for Metal Blade Records. And so this was like a documentary that Metal Blade released on DVD, Cannibal Corpse's record label, with a documentary and with all these concerts. So the whole DVD runs like 7 hours. But I just watched the documentary, a mere 3 hours.
For 3 hours.
Yes. I missed my whole Cannibal Corpse phase. They were a little early. I grew up in Buffalo, suburbs of Buffalo, to be clear. Born in 81, so I was a little young when they were like really hitting it in Buffalo. So I kind of missed them, and now I'm trying to get back into it now. I just bought tickets to see them in New York City with Mayhem, Blood Incantation, and Gore Guts, and I can't wait.
How are you into this particular genre of music?
I've known about Cannibal Corpse forever because there's not a lot of bands that came from Buffalo that okay. became successful. So it's like Goo Goo Dolls, Ani DiFranco, and you know, then you're running low until you go back to Rick James. But in terms of recent bands, and then Cannibal Corpse. And so I've always been curious about them, but I never got too deep. I never got into death metal. I was into thrash. So I was into Megadeth and Metallica when I was in high school. But I've always been curious about it, but never fully delved into it. Maybe because they're very disreputable. They've never gotten radio play. They've never gotten mass media exposure. They've survived on relentlessly touring. I guess it was kind of tied into also, I finally became like a record guy. You know, I got a beard, so why not? I became a record guy. And so I got a Cannibal Corpse album as well. And their debut, Eaten Back to Life, of course. And I quite enjoy it. They have these, you know, punishing rhythms, incredible drumming, you know, the guttural vocals you do have to get used to, but I did. So then I, you know, came across this on YouTube and it blew my mind.
Yeah. The guttural vocals, they are very interesting to me because they come out of being kind of monstrous or threatening, or is it just kind of an unprettying of like a rock voice?
In my experience, it's like taking apart the vocals and making it into like a textural element to make it part of the music. Corpse Grinder. He takes over for Chris Barnes. Mm-hmm. You got to follow him on Instagram. He's very good at the claw machine games. So he's like this big, so he's this big family man. He has, you know, anytime he's on tour, he goes to these claw games and he always wins stuffed animals, and there's a lot of photos of him that's like his arms filled with stuffed animals to bring home to his kids. And that's part of the vibe of the documentary is just, you know, they're all kind of lovable in their own freakish way. And also the contrast with their personalities and the kind of tightly knit community they've built entirely outside of mainstream ways of making money in the music business, because they've been going forever. This was a movie about their 30 years in the business that was, you know, made almost 20 years ago. It was 87 to 2007, and
Oh,
they're
wow.
still going. Yeah, so, and they're still going, and they're still in, you know, selling out these small arenas because they have a very passionate fan base, and it's inspiring. So
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to seeing them for the first time after all this time.
Yeah.
And one of the other things about the documentary is, you know, that I got a lot out of is the scenes of Buffalo, and also the interviews with all the guys from that scene, like the fans and the other bands of the time. They're all coming up at the same time, and they all have these awesome Sabres hats. Now, I was trying to analyze this because I saw no Buffalo Bills gear whatsoever, and I was like, how is this possible? So I'm watching this and everybody's just wearing Sabres hats, and like that, you know, also kind of reflects their underdog mentality. And another section that I loved, kind of an education for me about how death metal developed in Tampa, was because everybody wanted to go there because of this one engineer. He did one of the early Sepultura albums, engineer Scott Burns, and he would work at the studio Morris Sounds out of Tampa. And the first one, not the first, but the big breakout album for Sepultura, Beneath the Remains, everybody was like, well, this sounds incredible. He actually knows how to mic because the drums are so punishing. Like a lot of times, I guess the early recordings, they were just very muddy. And this guy would actually cared and showed the care to actually have all the instruments come through. And so everybody wanted to work with him. So they moved to Tampa and got to work with Scott Burns, who produced or engineered like a lot of the classic death metal albums from this period. And working with him kind of took them to from like a local curiosity to a touring act. So that section was really fascinating for me as well. And also the shots of them like driving in this beaten down van from Buffalo all the way down to Tampa, like these maniacs with no money in this broken down van, and they made it, and they're so that part was really cool too.
I don't have a great segue.
All right, I'll make a connection. So
Oh.
like, you know, the lyrics and Cannibal Corpse, they're extremely gory. There's a great scene in Warlock where Julian Sands like rips a guy's tongue out, and then he throws it in the frying pan. The implication is he's going to like fry it up and eat it, but you don't get to see that because we're segueing into the great Julian Sands, who,
Yes.
after I saw that he passed away, I'm not deep into his career, but I always loved Warlock, not only because it always called to me, like the video cover was everywhere in every video store, of him like he looked kind of impish,
Yeah.
but it was like this creepy horror movie. But revisiting it today, I never realized that that was actually a script by David Tui, who I really like and admire as a writer and director of you know, Pitch Black and that series, and also the Ghost Submarine movie Below. And he's made a lot of great films, and I just didn't real I never knew that he wrote the script for this. So, and it's very funny. It's way much funnier than I remember. I guess when I was a kid, I was just more impressed with the horror elements of it, but it is quite silly, and Julian Sands really plays it up. Have you ever seen this one?
I haven't seen it since I was a kid. I really don't. It's just like one of those things you kind of inhale.
So Julian Sands is a warlock, of course, the titular warlock in the 17th century, and they're about to like execute him, and of course he wriggles his way out, and there's some kind of spell, and he gets transported to the 20th century. And also, just hot on his heels is the witch hunter played by Richard E. Grant. And they're back in through in their 20th century, and they land in the house of like Laurie Singer, who's like, I guess she's like a, she's, you know, a cool young chick who's like, I guess new wave is her style, I guess. And so she gets like wrapped up into it. Richard E. Grant is she helps him try to chase down this guy because the warlock curses her to age, I think it's 40 years every day. So she's gonna die in like 3 days. And she's like very vain. So it's kind of the worst thing that could possibly happen to her. Yeah. And there's a very funny scene with Mary Warrenov as the proprietor of a supernatural store, and they're kind of doing a seance, and she gets her wish, and how, of contacting, you know, a supernatural being, and she pays the price. But it's like kind of like very broad, silly comedy. At one point, he's like, Julian Sands sees a boy, and he asks him to play football, and of course, he sucks the kid's soul. Yeah, that's just the way it is. And I think it believes it gives him the power of flight, that old story. But Julian Sands plays it for all it's worth, like extremely like slithery, oily, very self-satisfied warlock attitude. I think it's a wonderful performance. It was a joy. And by the way, of course, I watched it on our finest streaming service, Tubi, for all to watch with commercials, and directed by Steve Miner, who is like not a guy who I'm that familiar with, but I think he's done some like cool exploitation stuff, a lot of TV. Did the original House and some Friday the 13th and a lot of TV.
House is
But oh
definitely.
yes, Lake Placid. Lake Placid was what I was thinking of.
Ah,
That's a pretty
okay.
good monster movie.
That is good. No, and House is like, classic, 80s video rental. I don't know. It did creep me out for some reason.
That's another one. The House and House 2, the covers were like a siren song, and I had to for some reason I think I liked House 2 better. I have vague memories because it was funnier. That was always my standard. I didn't want to get scared too bad. But yeah, it had like a little skeleton hands like about to ring the doorbell. I think that was it.
But wait, there was that was that was one Warlock was one written by David Tui, but you had two by Tui.
I had two. So yeah, so like, and one of my favorite Blu-ray releases this year was Tui's first film that he directed, originally titled Timescape, but then retitled, perhaps an even better title, Grand Tour: Disaster in Time. And this is a movie I hadn't known existed. I think it was theatrically released as Timescape, and it's a Jeff Daniels sci-fi. It has a very Twilight Zone kind of vibes, and he's restoring this house. His wife has passed. He has a daughter, and he's going to turn it into a hotel. And then all of a sudden, these people show up. These strange, strangely dressed people show up on a tour, and they want the rooms now before the house is even complete. And he eventually discovers that they are time travelers from the future. And they are disaster tourists. They're dark tourists. They show up from the past to watch a horrible disaster happen that they know happened, of course, because they're from the future. And Jeff Daniels is appalled and thinks this is like morally horrific. And it's kind of interesting because my wife runs a ghost tour company in New York City called Burrows of the Dead. Check it out. And you know, she's always interested in you know, the morality of, you know, dark tourism. And I think that's become something people have talked more about in recent years, about how, you know, the morality of that, like you're getting entertainment on the pain of people from the past. I mean, my wife Andrew is always trying to ground things in the historical and try not to make anything fantastical and make it into entertainment. But you know, that's something that, you know, she's thinks about all the time. And so you're watching that with her was interesting, because like that's what they're doing. They're rubbernecking disasters. And so there's something disaster about to happen in his town, and he is going to try his damnedest to try and stop it somehow. And it has this very kind of Twilight Zone-y, Rod Serling-y twist, and it is kind of a morality tale about the moral corruption of these people from the future who can't feel anything anymore. So they're trying to get a Jones from the tragedies of the past, which I think is applicable to dark tourism today. And Jeff Daniels is like great as this aggrieved, hairy dad, a lot of good character performance. That's kind of a thought-provoking, well-made little movie that I kind of didn't realize existed. It was released on Blu-ray by this company, Unearthed Films, and I highly recommend it. And I believe Dewey's making another Pitch Black movie because that's the only movie you can get funding for anymore. I think it's like when Vin Diesel decides, has time in between Fast and Furious, he's like, let's make another one. Good for Vin. He keeps David Dewey working, which makes me happy because he's one of my favorites. So that one was kind of a nice surprise that
Yeah,
kind of snuck up.
I definitely want to see that one. I mean, it's I had occasion to rewatch on a plane The Terminator, which I did on the date of the events in the movie without intending to. But I love that this kind of I love the way movies, in a certain period, and I think this is especially true, maybe even related to just, I don't know, proliferation of video, but that they just kind of cross-pollinate, and so this is like it's a time travel premise, but it's this particular one. It's one, a dark tourism time travel premise. That's kind of interesting. But it is interesting that time travel often does lend itself to like all these different permutations.
Yeah, it was kind of a spin I hadn't seen before in a time travel movie. Maybe there's another one like it out there, but it seemed pretty original. I was into it.
It's kind of a pretty gratuitous use of presumably very complex technology just to come and look around and watch terrible stuff happen.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of it because they're so advanced and they've eliminated like all pain, so they don't have anything to do. So this is what they have left. The only thing that'll make them feel alive is to watch people suffer horribly. Yeah, it's very dark and disturbing stuff, man. Yeah, and there's one part where Jeff Daniels is playing against himself because he goes back in time, and so he like breaks himself out of prison. That's a very funny scene.
Does he play himself twice, like on screen, or?
Yeah, it's like split screen kind of trickery. It's very funny and well done. I like all that kind of gimmickry as well. It's the kind of thing that could have been made any time. Like it's very like simple, and the effects are effective. And yeah, I think it could have been made like any time in film history. I think just a very straightforward, well done. I dig it, man.
And then you saw, then you got out of the house and you saw something, a
What are you
screening.
implying? Are you implying that I never leave the house?
I'm just
I leave the house.
you're outside of your house right now, in fact. You're standing in the howling wind of a local park.
That's right. That's right. Can't you hear it?
No, it's more just that in the particular selection, completely randomly, were products of home viewing.
That's true.
But the next title that you'll talk about is another genre film. Also another film that I think kind of blurs the present and the past because it is sort of prescient, I guess. And I like doing these build-ups where do not name the
I don't
movie.
know where you're going with this. I can't wait to see where you're going to land. I mean,
It's a movie you saw at a light industry screening.
yes, I had to go. I haven't been to the new location in East Williamsburg, and I really wanted to check it out. I just haven't had an opportunity. And they were screening The Day the Earth Caught Fire, directed by Val Guest, and introduced by Dan Fox. And they had a 16 millimeter print, like a cut down print. They like cut down to like 4x3. I guess it was probably shown at non-theatrical exhibition or colleges, places like that. And it's this very harrowing apocalyptic scenario where, guess what? The earth is warming at an apocalyptic rate, and everybody's going to die because of it. And it's not the causes are not the causes that are leading to today's climate change. The causes in this movie are the US and Russia both exploded nuclear weapons at the same time, which tipped the Earth off its axis. thereby changing the atmosphere and the weather everywhere in the world, and also eventually, whoops, sending the Earth hurtling towards the sun.
Oh,
And
jeez.
everybody is going to burn alive. There's no doubt about it. And it's shot in a, kind of semi-docu-fiction fashion. It's focuses on these reporters in London, and they are trying to track the story because initially there's some weird things happening. There's earthquakes happening in random places around the world. There's like extra sunspot activity. Then there's like this extended heat wave, and they're not getting any answers from the government. So they're getting basically, they're always drunk all the time, essentially. And
Well,
in, like,
understandably.
yes, they're just getting blitzed and trying to get answers from the government and not getting any. So they're coming up with their own theories about what might be happening, writing stories about, the daily lives of people in the city that are getting worse and worse. And there's this harrowing scene where this enormous fog just envelops the whole town and everybody has to stay inside. And so, that part felt like pandemic era, like the streets are empty. You're not allowed to move around. You can't get through the city. They want you to stay inside. So there's echoes of that in it. And then when like the fields are ablaze, you're thinking about, the wildfires, and then you're thinking about, the rising temperatures. And it was like a very harrowing, a devastating experience to watch, honestly. Like, I mean, it has its limitations as a film. Now, I'm not coming from a place of experience with Val Guest. I know his biggest film, Quatermass Experiments, I haven't seen, but from what I understand, it uses a similar kind of style, similar kind of verite style. I guess that was shot in like a new development after World War II. But this one is just in the city, and you see, I guess, printing presses that then Fox said no longer exist because they were kind of destroyed when what's that guy's name? The Fox guy,
Rupert Murdoch.
Rupert Murdoch. Yeah, I guess he moved all the newspapers somewhere else and destroyed all the printing presses. So you got to see all those printing presses that are no longer there along the way. And like in a lot of street scenes just in London of people chilling, enjoying themselves until the disaster. The effects, the effects can be dodgy. Some of their performances are hit and miss. I mean, I really liked one of there's one jowly, the guy who does a lot of the environment writing, the scientific writing, is this jowly drunk who's always like making quips. He was phenomenal. Leo McKern is the man's name. He played like the science writer at the newspaper. And he was fantastic, very gruff, funny, always joshing the main character, who is like a former author, like a failed writer who they just hired at the paper as a favor. And they both have the growing realization that the world might be ending. So Edward Judd is the actor who plays the main character, Peter Stenning. He's like our guide through this. There's like a framing device he takes over on the phone, telling a guy, the story of the last few months, and he takes us through it. And he's, this failed author, a drunk, and he's trying to make sense of it all, fall in love maybe at the same time before everything goes to dust. And yeah, I didn't even mention that they speculate that the one of the problems is the melting of the ice caps as well.
Oh,
Like, it's like got a lot of stuff in it.
there you
It's
go.
very depressing, and the ending, it's very open-ended. There's a very funny visual joke. So there's one last gasp they try to save the world is, of course, to set off more nuclear weapons
Of course.
to change the course of the Earth. And it kind of ends, on a cliffhanger, you don't know. And there's a panning shot in the printing press, and it starts with, you pass by one headline that says "World Saved," then it keeps panning to the right, and then there's another option that says "World Doomed." So, because they have both front pages ready to go in case this last ditch effort fails. Now, why they would print the paper if the
That's
world was ending in a day, I don't know, but they do say over and over again, we got to get the paper out. They love their paper, and God bless them for that. Yeah, it was quite something. I was, really impressed with it. And, it's hard, and you can't separate it, like with the movie as it is, from the prescience of what we're going through today. Like, I don't know, because you have a different associations with seeing it back in 1961. And Dan Fox's introduction, he was saying, they just stopped rationing maybe 7 years before that. There are a lot of, places still bombed out from World War II, so they're coming from the perspective of just getting out of the war and all the horrors that came out of that. And so that might have been the frame of reference seeing it then. And today it's just purely the climate apocalypse. This is what you see when you see this movie. And the fact that it can remain so effective in those different contexts, I think, is a tribute to its creativity and its effectiveness as a movie. Even though it doesn't have standard movie greatness indicators, I mean, it's, some of the effects, as I said, can be dodgy, but to me they were pretty fatefully effective. And there's some, like, creaky romance, not very believable, between Peter Stenny and Jeannie Craig, who plays Janet, who works at the government institute that's covering things up. But I mean, still, it's still quite something.
It's funny when there's a perceived need to have throw in some romance, like that's going to rope in some extra segment of the crowd.
It's coming out of this exploitation kind of space, and so they have to have scantily clad women. Like, she's off been disrobing, so Jeannie Craig's often disrobing or in a state of undress. And so they had, like, this is obviously like part of the production. If you make this movie, you have to have a lot of partially dressed women, or you're not going to get the movie made. I'm sure that's, part of the package deal when you're making these low budget productions. So that's in there as well.
Well, that is a movie that I'm going to track down.
Oh, you got to check it out. And I didn't catch him, but apparently Michael Caine is in it as a police officer, but I didn't catch him. Maybe because it was on 16, maybe if I saw it bigger. But I didn't recognize him. I didn't recognize him. I guess he's directing traffic.
He's probably obscured by those giant bobby hats that they have.
That's probably it.
That's probably it.
I would say so. Arthur Christensen is a former editor of the Daily Express, and he plays the editor of the newspaper. And he is definitely an editor, not an actor. I'll say that
What are you
much.
saying about editors? They can't
I'm saying he can't act. He
act.
sucks. No, he was fine.
Well, then that my requisite mention of journalists turned filmmakers or turned film people, Sam Fuller obviously being the big example there. But I did want to mention that there was something that was nagging me about the whole Earth turning on its axis thing. Well, one is that it's kind of funny that that's something about it. Just, yeah, Columbo style. It was just one last thing about the Earth turning on its axis. But it's that, I think that's actually is happening now. I mean, not to the extent in the movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but it's happening because of groundwater. Like, we're pulling up so much groundwater that it's like, that is for some reason turning the Earth on its axis, but maybe it's more of a
Oh,
magnetic thing. I don't know.
didn't know that.
What I'm trying to tell you, Rob, is you watched a documentary.
Yeah, I guess so. Unbelievable. Yeah, this is kind of, it's just really remarkable. I was kind of like watching it jaw agape.
But it's also funny how, like, nukes, the nuclear threat is like sort of secondary to the fact of like climate change, although there is still very much the
Yes,
prospect.
seeing it today, that's in our perspective. Yeah, back then, I think the nuclear threat was probably much more terrifying, even though, yeah, it's obviously still present with us, but it's not as on our horizon of thought, not as present as the climate. I think for most people anyway. Try to check this out if you want to be further horrified. But so maybe don't check it out.
Maybe don't
I
check.
don't
I'll
know.
listen to some soothing Cannibal Corpse instead.
Yeah, just to wind down at the end of the day, at the end of a long day, crack open a beer, put on some Cannibal Corpse. And then throw on The Day the Earth Caught Fire.
That fire. There's one more movie we could talk about that is actually one that we've both seen, and
Low budget.
low budget.
low budget, resourceful. And we could swing it back to Warlock and say this is also available on Tubi.
Yes, it is on Tubi as Warlock, and as a pretty incredible array of movies is on there. I'm continually kind of amazed what's on Tubi. Like, someone just posted recently, like, apropos of I don't know what, they're like, here are all the Catherine Breillat movies that are on Tubi, or here are all the Catherine Breillat movies that are on streaming, and four or five of them are on Tubi.
It's crazy. Like everything from everywhere. It's just most stuff you wouldn't expect. It's quite a trove. I really don't mind watching things with commercials. It just takes me back to when I was a kid, you know. It's fine.
It's true. This particular one is called Locked In. Actually, kind of a fun premise.
It is a super fun premise. It's kind of a classic B movie scenario because you don't have to do many locations. It's like four women wake up tied up in a basement, and they have to, as they slowly get their memories back, because they wake up with no memory of how they got there, they have to piece together why they're there, the connections between each of them. And once they figure out what the connection is, they have to figure out how to get out of that situation and whether actually to trust each other. So it's kind of a very clever way to tell a story without having to use a lot of locations. And it was like pretty solid, I must say. I mean, it's extremely low budget. This looks like it was made, you know, on nothing. Like you could just a camera and some actors and some ingenuity and you make it happen. And there's some really, I thought that the actress who played Treasure was hilarious. She's
He's
like,
correct.
you know, poison tongues. She's always got an insult for everybody. Joy Rostin is the actress. I thought she was fantastic. Yeah, I thought a good job of keeping you on your toes, trying to like hiding and revealing things at different times, you know, keep flashing back to each character's past to reveal little bits and pieces of what's going on. Now, I mean, it certainly has its creakiness. Some of the actors are, you know, they're just probably starting out, so not everybody's is smooth as Joy is for me, but I thought it was really clever, and it's a fun little B movie, which is not made enough these days, I would say.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, you have people who pay tribute to B movies or will name check B movies or something, but to actually make one, or make a low budget movie like this and be successful at it on those terms, it's really impressive. And like, in retrospect, I'm like, I think about decisions, that the director made. Like, the basement that they're locked in is blue tinted, or like because of like fluorescence, I guess. But I also sort of realized, like, well, that's really clever because, like, you just don't have to worry about the production design at all. It like looks cool, but also you don't have to worry about that. So you're just totally focused on the people who are there.
Well, I liked how cluttered the basement was. It
It
just
is, yeah, it's
filled
a real
with
basement.
crap. And like, yeah, you know, I was like, I immediately started thinking, like, why would he lock them down here? There's like so many weapons.
Yeah, that's
As it
true.
turns out, he just might not be a smart guy. And that's like totally reasonable. And it's refreshing to see the villain who's just like, yeah, he's, you know, makes a lot of terrible decisions. And like the thing, it's a B movie, that's a B movie. Like the problem with a lot of things that are inspired by B movies, which is the majority of blockbuster films today, is that they're 3 hours long and cost $300 million. It's like, you know, Indiana Jones, that's like a serial, you know, all the Star Wars stuff, all that. So I mean, it's refreshing to see a B movie that's just a B movie, and it's smart, and you know, it's clearly has constraints. Like there's not a lot of, you know, lighting, but it does well with what it's got, I would say. Yeah, so it was fun. So, you know, thanks for that recommendation, and I want to check out the other stuff that you wrote about in your New York Times article about these a lot of Black independent films that Tubi is airing.
Well, one thing I love is that, I mean, I should say that it sounds like a kind of menacing premise. I mean, obviously, to an extent it is, but there's also just a lot of comedy in it. The movie mines a lot of comedy gold out of them just suspecting each other, and then having this just hand grenade of a personality with Treasure there, who is just never going to say the helpful thing. It's just like constantly stirring the pot. And so, yeah, there's a lot of amnesia comedy in a way, which is yeah. I think doesn't at one point she has a, like a little riff where she's like, "Oh man, my parents must have been really cool to name me Treasure."
That's right. She was impressed after she started remembering her name. Yeah, and she was impressed with her parents for naming her that. Yeah, Gillian Holt, the screenwriter, kudos, and David C. Snyder, the director. So, yeah, I'd be looking forward to seeing what they do next. I wanted to see the one with Mike Coulter. So, can you tell me more about that one? Because Mike Coulter, I just saw on Plane, which was one of my favorite like action movies I saw this year. Jean-Francois Richer, who did the Assault on Precinct 13 remake, which I thought was pretty good.
Yeah,
I don't
I
know,
thought that was pretty good too.
Plane was really similarly resourceful on a bigger budget, of course. But yeah, what's the Mike Coulter one? Can
Well,
you clue me in here?
yeah, that one is called Murder City, being like Detroit, which is actually where a number of the movies on Tubi are produced. I mean, of these independent films, it's which is another thing I love about it is that you see kind of directors and producers working from different semi self-created like industry centers like Detroit, or I mean, in the case of Locked In, I think that's based around Cleveland more. So that's kind of interesting. So yeah, Murder City. Also, the thing about Murder City is it's probably more polished, and I think the beats are more like a little more conventional than Locked In, which kind of quickly becomes like this kind of cat's cradle of double crosses and like cutaways and flashbacks, which I'm not even sure entirely can be untangled, but I didn't really care. But Murder City is more straightforward. Mike Coulter plays kind of just like a, to a certain extent, like a lazy cop. He's corrupt and he, you know, will take money off of a kid he busts for dealing. But then he actually gets in serious trouble and he goes to jail for a couple of years when he helps his dad with like a drug drop slash drug deal. And when he comes out, he's like lost his job as a cop on the force, and it seems all he can do and is work for this kingpin played by Stephanie Sigmund called Ash, and she's just a very ruthless drug baron basically who like at the drop of a hat like double crosses people and works with the FBI who's also corrupt. So he works for her. He doesn't really want to be working for her. And the movie is kind of about him finding a way to extract himself and also regain the trust of his wife, who was A, none too pleased that he went to jail for helping his dad with a drug deal, but also B is doesn't have a lot of faith, wants to, yeah.
I'm in. I'm sold. I want to become a culture head. I'm ready.
Yeah, he's good. I mean, he has like a it's a kind of tough and vulnerable thing because I wish I knew the actor who plays his brother because he has a brother in the film who's also working for this gang and but is also still addicted. So his kind of struggle is kind of an interesting subplot as well. But yeah, but as I say, like this one, you know, has actual like lighting setups that are more
Yeah,
traditional.
I mean, yeah, I'm sure it'll have totally separate charms, but
Yeah.
I'm definitely that's one I'm bookmarking, and I definitely want to check out next. I love delving into different corners of crime movies, or what stands for B movies these days, which I guess this definitely would qualify.
Yeah. Well, one more thing I would say about Murder City, sort of compared with something like Locked In, is that, I mean, Murder City is part of, which is sort of what I wrote about a bit, is part of this initiative to produce more movies under a certain banner that's called Black Noir Cinema. What's it seems to me is like it's kind of they're doing more polished versions of movies that are on there. And, you know, I think they're all kind of great, but I have a soft spot for like the less polished stuff because,
Sure,
you
of
know, where
course.
the edges aren't sanded off and there's almost just more of a looseness or a spontaneity. So it's just kind of it'll be interesting to see how Tubi kind of maintains these like similar but maybe slightly diverging like, you know, ecosystems of independent movies, you know, some which are, you know, maybe a little more polished and more cleanly put together, and then the other where they're still like acquiring these independent productions, which I basically I hope they continue to do that because I think it's really fun.
Absolutely, because there's not a lot of places where you can see, zero budget movies, like truly, Locked In. It's like a truly independent movie. Like they just made that movie and got it on Tubi with no support. Like that's like so, inspiring and commendable, just like the Cannibal Corpse guys in a similar way. They're just doing their thing and getting it out there, and hopefully they can find an audience as much as Cannibal Corpse did. So, and I hope both tracks can cook. I like both sides. I'm looking forward to seeing Murder City and seeing more what that looks like, a more polished prime stoic ex-cop. But I want to see how Coulter, tweaks his like stoic persona thing that he's got going on. So looking forward to it.
I mean, also just not having like there has, doesn't have to be like a value hierarchy, I guess, is another thing. You know, like
No, not at
we can
all.
have both.
And I'm sure some of them are terrible and some of them are great in both. But I like exploring. That's the fun. That's part of the fun is exploring. So, thanks for pointing me in this direction because, it's hard to keep track of everything that's coming out and all these streamers that are, ruining our lives.
So yeah, that's Locked In, and then Murder City. I mean, there's also the titles of the Tubi movies are just they're all great. Like by this the same director of Locked In did another one called Scam Likely.
Oh, have you seen this? I mean, that's a great title.
I have. It's I like that one too. I think Locked In is like a tighter film, but Scam Likely is good too. It's kind of merges more with there. I mean, there's a whole ongoing theme on Tubi of women who are drawn into crime by appealing but
Some
ultimately
dirtbag
unsavory
guy.
men, by some dirtbag guy. So that's kind of along those lines. And I have to say, those dramas are like pretty interesting. And this one also has like this ongoing voiceover where she chronicles what's happening to her as she's getting drawn into it.
Also written by Gillian Holt. Interesting. Here we go.
Oh, yeah.
We got a dream team going on here.
Yeah, they have something, something going, yeah.
Oh my, three. Gillian Holt wrote three in 2022. I'm hoping for more. 2021. Yeah, very productive.
Yeah.
Oh, one of them is a short, though. Short. Workout Partners. Should I check this out?
I don't know. I couldn't really get into it. Also, I was like watching, trying to cram in within the course of like a week, like, 70 of these or something. So
It's okay, Nick. It's okay if one of them is bad.
it's
It's all
bad.
right.
Okay. I love all my Tubi children. Yeah, plenty to sample. We could sort of end there. I do want to just mention one, just give a little shout out, one little piece of rep movie going. And I went to Metrograph for a series of shorts by Tom Palazzolo, who's a documentary filmmaker, verite style, basically doing these shorts like in and around Chicago. He's Chicago centered, so Chicago based, in like the 60s and 70s and later. Which I don't know, the ones I like the most are ones that kind of show a friendly but also humorous eye, just the community like events. So like parades, there's like a beauty contest. There's one, I mean, genuinely touching one called Ricky and Rocky, which is about some backyard thing that for some reason is also a surprise, where Ricky and Rocky are just given a bunch of presents and they announce each one and who gave it and thank people individually with a PA like microphone.
Very sweet.
I don't know. There's just something very sweet about the whole thing. And you kind of, when you watch these things, you kind of keep expecting it to tilt over into like, oh, look at these like rubes or something. But he doesn't, I don't think he really does that. I mean, there are ones where he's doing things for kind of like making a political point about, I don't know, Republicans and the Vietnam War and very justified targets. But yeah, in this case, I was just like, oh, wow, okay. And it's this one, at least when I saw it at Metrograph, they were showing a print that I guess was restored by Jeff Krinus, who is this veteran verite filmmaker from the prime of the period. Anyway, he restored it, and the color is just like, it's kind of mind blowing. It's like this bubblegum Kodachrome color. It's really nice.
Nice.
So there's that, and then there's like a one called Pets on Parade, which is exactly what it sounds, a kind of low energy parade of pet owners, including a poor girl whose guinea pigs keep multiplying.
What could be more delightful than
What
that?
could be more
Yeah.
exactly, and one where he visits a massage parlor in Chicago and just kind of hangs out in the waiting room. I don't know, that's again just like something that manages to be really pretty just sweet, you know.
And some of these are available on in
Oh, yes,
to
this is
view.
they are. I mean, it's great that they're being projected, and I'm not sure they've. I think they're being projected with. I don't know if it's an actually complete retrospective. It's probably the most extensive retrospective, at least since I saw a bunch of them at Anthology when they were showing restorations of them, fresh rest in like the 2000s in New York. They were shown in True False, I think, in 2020. That might have been like the genesis of this particular program. But that being said, I think most or maybe even all of his shorts are available online at the Chicago Film Archive. So you can actually just stream them there because they have. You know, it's like a library. You click around and you'll find like the Tom Palazzolo collection. And then you can actually click through and watch them.
It's
So
incredible.
you can watch the massage one, which is called Hot Nasty,
Oh boy.
which I think is the name of the place. And I think Ricky Rocky is there as well in Pet Sematary.
I'm totally unfamiliar with him. I mean, they sound lovely, so I definitely want
Yeah. I mean, I do want to say a number of them are pretty, like, they're pretty modest.
to. Yeah, that sounds like the value of them is part of the value is
Yeah.
the modesty, right?
No, it's true. Yeah.
And when you mentioned the Kodachrome, this reminded me that apparently, I guess in some of like if you were on 35 prints or something of when the Earth caught fire, I guess they did apply some like effects to the film to make it look like it was on fire or something. So it might
Oh.
be worthwhile if it ever does show on film. I would like to check that out and see what they did.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, apparently they might have applied some effect to the film to make it look like I don't know if solarized it or something. I don't know. But I do want to see it on film if that ever comes around, which might not be likely. But
That makes me think of like some tinting in like silent
yeah,
flick.
tinting. That might be all it is, but
Well, we can bring things in for a conclusion there.
bring it home,
Bring it home.
land this thing.
Land this crazy, crazy plane. Thank you for educating me about Cannibal Corpse. I will probably listen to the music before I listen to the documentary, full disclosure.
You don't have a spare 3 hours.
Being plunged into that might be too much for my delicate
All
constitution.
right, I forgive you. I forgive you.
Well, now we can our outro can be if you have a whatever it may be, a Blu-ray set or something.
Sure. I mean, Kino Lorber distributed the Metrograph Pictures Blu-ray of Millennium Mambo. Got Cameron Austin Collins to do an audio commentary for that, which is really lovely. So I would highly recommend picking that up. It's like a beautiful 4K restoration of that, I don't know, indefinable Tou Hsiao-hsien film. So, and it's, not been well represented on home video over the years. So I hope you give it a try.
I definitely second that, especially on a Blu-ray, because I mean, yeah, no revelation to say that his movies are some of the most entrancingly beautiful creations. I mean, if I could just see The Assassin one more time in a movie theater, I would love to do that.
But Millennium Mambo might be the most beautiful of his films. I don't know. It's hard to pick.
Yeah, very good, Rob. Pleasure as always.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me. It's always fun.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapold. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.